Good morning, this is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for Saturday, March 20th. Before we get to the topic of healthcare, as we're all supposed to sit around this weekend waiting for elected members of Congress to work real hard on a $1 trillion piece of legislation, the full contents of which are still largely unknown, we have a few other important issues, such as our relationship with China. The war of words heated up anew over China's currency policy as Premier Wen Jiabao repeatedly defended his nation's right to do as it pleased, saying Beijing opposed finger-pointing or taking strong measures to force a readjustment of the yuan. And then he added the usual complaints on arms sales to Taiwan and the White House's reception to the Dalai Lama, though on these last two, don't sweat it. It's just that now is hardly the time to get into a shouting match with China when it comes to the economy, and trust me, as to the cries of protectionism from Washington, the United States is just as guilty as the next guy. For starters, think sugar. Editorial Wall Street Journal. As if the world economy wasn't fragile enough, politicians in the U.S. and China seem intent on fighting an old-fashioned currency war. The U.S. is more wrong than China here, and it's important to understand why, lest the two countries send the world back to the dark age of beggar-thy-neighbor currency protectionism. The battle concerns China's decision to peg its currency, the yuan, to a fixed rate of roughly 6.83 to one U.S. dollar. I would just add that it's been at this level since mid-2008. To hear the American political and business establishment tell it, this single price is the source of all global economic problems. The peg keeps the yuan undervalued in this telling, fueling China's exports and harming the U.S., Europe, and everyone else. If the Chinese would only let the yuan float, it would soar in value. China's export advantage would fall, and the much-despised imbalances in global trade would end. But numerous countries continue to peg their currencies to the dollar, and with the establishment of the euro, most of Europe decided to move to a fixed-rate system. The reason isn't to get some trade advantage against their neighbors, but to gain the economic benefits of stable exchange rates, and in some cases, a more stable monetary policy. A stable exchange rate eliminates a major source of uncertainty for investment decisions and trade and capital flows. By maintaining a fixed yuan dollar rate, China has subcontracted much of its monetary discretion to the Fed in return for the benefits of exchange rate stability. For more than a decade, this has served the world economy well, leading to an explosion of trade, cheaper goods for Americans that have raised U.S. living standards, and new prosperity for tens of millions of Chinese. That was the Wall Street Journal. Oh, there is more, and I understand the flip side. But China is sending an envoy to the U.S. in an attempt to cool things down. For now, the World Bank has upped its GDP forecast for China to 9.5% this year, and the government is tightening and bringing down the loan level to slow the real estate bubble, for starters. The World Bank is saying this policy will work. As for the latest on the Greece situation, Prime Minister Papandreou set a one-week deadline for the European Union to craft a financial aid mechanism for his country, as Germany, after first saying no way, hinted it would be willing to support a joint European government-led and International Monetary Fund bailout. But at the end of the week, France was saying no to any thought of IMF involvement, as President Nicolas Sarkozy said there had to be just a European solution. The German people in no way want to help Greece, while Greece requires certainty and backup if it is to be able to market its bonds as a reasonable interest rate versus more stable euro countries. So Papandreou wants guarantees of last-ditch support if needed by end of next week when there is to be a summit in Brussels. The problem with Greece just going the IMF route is that it sends a terrible signal to the global financial community as to the strength of the entire European Union, and thus would adversely impact the euro common currency further. When it comes to healthcare, I thought the Financial Times' Clive Crook pretty well summed it up, quote, "Already beyond abstruse, now in the realm of surreal farce, the debate is thus becoming yet more inward-looking and unintelligible. Can the language on abortion be included in a reconciliation measure? Probably not. Can the Senate parliamentarian be overruled? What is the Senate parliamentarian? All that is missing is a speech in favor of the plan by Groucho Marx. Recovering voters' respect for the outcome Even assuming the outcome is good looks an ever more distant prospect. That was Clive Crook. But with a vote looming on Sunday, at least as of now, what's crazy, among the many things about this whole deal and process that are nuts, is that Obamacare doesn't really begin to go into effect until 2013 at the earliest. But to avoid total annihilations at the polls, come November, the Democrats have to lay out some goodies before this fall, and I'm not sure just what they will be, beyond parents being able to tell their children, no, you cannot come under our health plan just because you're under 26. And before you know it, it will be 2012. What's the situation going to be for Obama's reelection effort? Some say the Democrats will look to expand Obamacare further before then, but it seems impossible. They'd have the kinds of necessary majorities to get it through after the midterm vote. Robert Samuelson, Washington Post. One job of presidents is to educate Americans about crucial national problems. On health care, Barack Obama has failed. Almost everything you think you know about health care is probably wrong, or at least half wrong. Great simplicities and distortions have been peddled in the name of achieving universal health coverage. The miseducation has worsened as the debate approaches its climax. There's a parallel here, housing. Most Americans favor home ownership, but uncritical pro-home ownership policies, lax lending standards, puny down payments, hefty housing subsidies, helped cause the financial crisis. The same thing is happening with healthcare. The appeal of universal insurance, who, by the way, wants to be uninsured, justifies half-truths and dubious policies. That the process is repeating itself suggests that our political leaders don't learn even from proximate calamities. Editorial, New York Post. Nancy Pelosi is a coward, a bully, and a hypocrite, and Barack Obama is hiding behind her skirt. So what does that make him? Pelosi obviously can't find enough votes in her own party for Obamacare, so the House Speaker is preparing to approve the president's health care bill by legislative legerdemain, that is, by not voting on it, and to hell with the Constitution. Not to mention President Obama's long-abandoned vow that the health care reform process would be completely open and transparent. Indeed, Pelosi has just the opposite in mind. She intends to employ an arcane bit of backroom alchemy known as deem and pass, in which the House would vote on a few less controversial fixes to the Senate's health care bill. Then, under terms of a special rule, such passage would automatically mean that the House deems that the entire bill has been approved. Say what? Well, Pelosi says no one wants to vote for the Senate bill. No kidding. If they did, it would have become law long ago, and now midterm congressional elections are rapidly approaching. That was the New York Post. But this whole deem and pass process is so confusing that as I write, no one can tell you for sure just what exactly is going to take place. What is clear is that the most important piece of legislation this century could be enacted without anyone actually voting on the 2,700-page behemoth, and there isn't a single soul in this country who knows what's in it, let alone they're still changing the House version as I write. Oh, sure, there's a subsidy for this group and one for that and another for them, and by magic it will still reduce the deficit because you have tax increases on the Medicare payroll tax and another on interest, dividends, and capital gains. No adverse impact on the economy for any of this, and so on. I'm just disgusted. Like a vast majority of Americans these days, I'm sick of Washington and our political process. I'm also sick of everyone feeling like they are entitled to this and entitled to that at no cost. But enough about my opinion. Peggy Noonan, in her journal op-ed, nailed an issue near and dear to my heart, how the rest of the world is viewing this mess. Ms. Noonan writes, "Excuse me, but it is embarrassing, really embarrassing to our country, that the President of the United States has again put off a state visit to Australia and Indonesia because he's having trouble passing a piece of domestic legislation he's been promising for a year will be passed next week. What an air of chaos this signals to the world. To do this to Australia of all countries, a nation that has always had America's back and been America's friend. How Bush League. How undisciplined. How kids stuff." That was Peggy Noonan. Stocks finished higher for the fifth week in six as the tepid rally continued. Frankly, come noon on Thursday and Friday, I, like more than 90% of the street, happily switched off CNBC for CBS and the NCAA basketball tournament. So with one eye on the TV and the other on the quote screen, you didn't have to be a rocket scientist to tell that volume on the exchanges dried up to a trickle, forgetting the fake action of the triple witch in options. And in 3 weeks with Tiger back at the Masters, it'll be the same thing for rounds 1 and 2, so plan your trading accordingly. In all honesty, the first 2 days of March Madness are the worst for me as I try to put this column together. Though otherwise, I make no apologies, especially since my Wake Forest Demon Deacons actually decided to show up against Texas and won in dramatic fashion. For those of you listening to the podcast Saturday morning or afternoon, I don't expect a similar dramatic ending against Kentucky. Anyway, the Dow Jones tacked on 1.1% to finish the week at 10,742, with the S&P up 0.9% and NASDAQ up 0.3%. All three are basically at 17-month highs. London actually hit a 21-month high. Earlier, the Fed's Open Market Committee got together to once again announce they would hold the line on interest rates for an extended period while offering that business spending was up significantly and the labor market was stabilizing, but housing remained dead in the water, or in some cases with the flooding across the country this week, literally underwater. The Fed will stop buying mortgage-backed securities as of March 31, but there is little indication rates will then move significantly higher in the short run. Bernanke and company are relying on private money to step in and fill the void, so longer term, this could create problems. One thing is for sure, though, while inflation may be perking up in Asia with rising food prices, India's central bank surprised the markets with a rate rise. It remains non-existent here, with February readings on producer and consumer prices coming in at -0.6% and unchanged, respectively, with the core rate up 0.1% in both cases. I do have to note my amusement when I see an article like in the March 22, 29 issue of Bloomberg Businessweek titled "Bull Market Believers, Three Money Managers Who Called the Turn in March 2009 See Big Gains Ahead, a Fourth Descent." None of the four mentioned geopolitical events as a potential cause for concern. It's like all four are off in their own little worlds, totally oblivious. I'll be back with you next Saturday, March 27th. Have a great week.